This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. I was recently in the Los Angeles area for the Masters of Illusion television series that was being filmed, and those episodes will be coming up sometime in the future as we get a little bit closer to the release of Season 9. Season 8, by the way, is currently playing on the CW network here in the United States, and Season 9 is going to be following that shortly, and I'm going to release a couple of episodes to give you a behind the scenes of what was going on of the filming of a television series like this. So that's coming up later, but while I was in Los Angeles, I had a chance to sit down with Ed Alonso, who is one of the performers not only in the 9th season, but he has been performing in many of the seasons, if not all of them. And so he has a very interesting background, and he is someone who you may have seen on Saved by the Bell, which was a long-playing television series. He is in other television series currently on HBO Max. There's a show called Minx, M-I-N-X, and that is has him as a bit part in there as well. Just so many things he's involved with. I remember the Long Beach Mystics, as well as having toured with Britney Spears. Yeah, Britney Spears. What a diverse background. This young man has done a lot already. And so I'm going to step out of the way and introduce Ed and let him tell his stories. He has a lot to say. I'm going to say a lot less this week than I normally do. So please welcome my guest and my friend this week, Mr. Ed Alonso, here on The Magic Word. Well, this evening we have a very special occasion. We are actually recording this in the Magic Castle in Hollywood, California, and I am talking with one of the people who has been a magician for quite some time. He was a member of the Junior Magicians as well as the Long Beach Mystics, and is now running for the board of directors for the Magic
Castle. The ballots just came out yesterday.
The ballots came out, so your name is on there.
My name is on the ballot. I voted for myself. And I hope that that's the vote that counts.
And this gentleman also not only is a magician, but also an actor, lives over in the Universal Studio area, Universal City. Perhaps you might have seen him or know him if you are a younger person and used to watch Saved by the Bell. He is on that because they rebooted it and they're in the second year of that's that right. again then right yep. now. Please welcome my friend. And also, of course, he's been touring with that other lady. What's her name?
Britney Spears. Yeah, she's been in the news lately. Yeah, she had an argument with her dad.
Again. So there you go. Please welcome my guest, Ed Alonso. Hey there,
Yay! It really is me. Here we are, and we're in the library, the secret library at the Magic Castle. Yes. And not everyone gets to come in here.
I feel special.
This is a crazy place. When I first became a junior member here, where we're sitting right now was the parking garage.
Okay.
And my mother used to drive me here from Valencia.
How far is Valencia to Hollywood?
Maybe 35 miles, 40 miles from here. So it'd be a half-hour drive. And she would pull right into this lower garage and park, and she had a couple books with her. I would run upstairs and join the juniors meeting that we had once a month. And
she would stay in the car and read?
She stayed in the car, would read, and, you know, because the meeting would only be a couple of hours, and she was great. And we'd grab lunch afterwards and then back to Valencia. But now, here it is. The library is down here. But the library was originally kind of upstairs where the offices are. So when I was a kid, I saw most of all these same books in a smaller area in another secret location. So this is really cool.
Yeah, the other location they had was above the kitchen, I believe. Isn't that right?
That's where it was, yeah. Right above the kitchen.
Now, it has expanded dramatically, I think, over the years.
Yeah, I mean, it's the size of a parking garage, if you heard my story. So, yeah, it's massive, and there are way more books here than when I was a kid. Wow, this is the place. I mean,
well, that's my point. Is as far as the books that are here, that it is much larger. Of course, I wondered if there was another storage area for the books they had that had been donated in someone's home or garage or something, and then once they had, it was like, here, take them.
Well, that's exactly what happened over the years. Members pass away and they leave us their libraries, and so then any books that the castle doesn't already have, they come right into the library. So yeah, this thing has grown leaps and bounds, and it's still one of the largest collections in the world. And there's rare books here. It's all here. Like, it's just amazing. Right. I'm just nervous sitting around them. I don't know half this stuff.
It appears they also have some sort of a, not a Dewey Decimal System, but they've got their own Di Vernon system or something. It looks like they've got little numbers and everything on all the numbers. I should probably talk with
Joe
Goodwin
or
someone.
Yeah, I have no idea how it works because, you know what, I really rarely come down here. Like I say, there's just so much. But if there was something specific that I needed, I would certainly come here. But most of the books that I get inspiration from, whatever, I have all those books. Mm-hmm. And so I'll
like
just...
What would be... People talk about your 5-foot bookcase. I mean, if you were on a desert island, what would be your top 2 or 3 or 10 books?
I have to say, okay, obviously the Tarbell course. Okay. That's a great one. And I only have one of the Tarbell books. I don't have the whole course. But I know all the
to buy a next one, right?
I'm trying to get the other 9 or 12 or whatever. But I do have... excuse me, my voice is so... I had the...
You got a duck in your throat?
Well, no, I had the... I had the Magic Castle chili.
Oh.
Now, you would think that that would affect you in another area. It's affecting my throat.
I'm hoping we're not going to go there.
Which probably you're much happier about.
Yes.
So, yeah. The... what were we saying?
Oh, we were talking about the... Boy, I've lost my train of thought.
You see what I did?
That's right, yes. Yeah, so we're talking about the books, and you have a lot of books in the top 3 or 5
yeah.
books you would take on an island.
Well, certainly the Tarbell course, which I've gone through many, many times, even though I just have the one book. I'll tell you why I just have one book. I never bought the Tarbell course because it always was just available here at the castle.
Oh.
I would spend a lot of time through the years when I was younger at Hollywood Magic. They always had it up there, and if I had something, I would just kind of peek through and, oh, that's okay, there it is. But I have one book, and I'll tell you what happened. My best friend is Neil Harris, who used to be the president here, and he brought me Tarbell book number 1. Mm-hmm. He said, it was for my birthday or whether years ago. He said, I've got you the Tarbell thing. I said, hey, this is great. I've got my first book, my first Tarbell book. Well, I opened the cover, and it said, to Ed, your friend, Doug Henning. So I was like, well, this is, what is this?
Yeah.
He says, there was another Ed, obviously, who Doug signed this for.
Yeah.
And there it is. And I was like, good enough for me. Well, I had met Doug a couple of times. He even came here and saw me once, Doug Henning did, which was just mind-blowing. And
did he come back and talk to you afterwards? Or?
Well, he just waited in the theater, him and Debbie. And I was doing, it was a brunch show. And rarely do I ever do the brunches now if I do a whole week. It's just, it's too exhausting. And then I feel like I got to change.
Because usually you do the whole thing. You don't like go with one or two.
Oh, no, I don't want to let any other magicians in there because, I can't look as good if I have somebody who's talented in there with me. So I hogged the whole stage. So I was in there doing my 3 spots at the time. And it was many years ago. I would also do the brunches as well. Now it's just I feel like I have to change the brunch shows to really make them custom fit to the families.
Families, right.
Yeah, not that there's any
blue
craziness
material,
blue material, but I
understand.
Anyone who's seen me sees that I do walk the line very carefully. So Doug and Debbie come in and they see the brunch, and I knew that he was out there. And at this time, I was doing my... I guess you would call it an early signature piece, the Straight Jacket Escape, where the duck comes out of the jacket at the end. And so I did this, and this was in the show. Anyway, Doug and Debbie, they waited. And so afterwards, everyone left, and there he was. And I went out, said hello, and he said, amazing, I have no idea where the duck came from. And I thought he was kidding me.
Yeah.
Because here he is, the master.
Right.
How could he not know? And so I was speechless. I said, wow, well, thank you. And then he kept going on. It's just amazing. I have no clue where. Well, I was almost in tears. I almost wanted to tell him how it was done.
Yeah.
But I didn't. But now then later to look back when Neil gave me that book, even though it was to a different, it could have been Ed Marlowe for all I know, who knows who it was, but still to have the book was so precious to me. And to spend the time with Doug here. And when he had his first big auction, I went and I bought several of the Doug Henning things, the barricaded barrels.
By today's standards, it's pretty cheap, the deals you got, I'm sure.
Well, it was. I paid a couple $1,000 for the barricaded barrels. I bought the Aikido cutting in thirds, which is the one he did with Bill Cosby on the show, where he pulled the center out and Julie Newmar was on the table. I own that illusion. and I've done it on TV a bunch of times. And I had a Little by Little and Gazinta boxes, where the one box looked like a crate and the other one was rainbows. And so I had all those. Over the years, I sold everything except for two items. The Center Cut song, which I still have, which one day I want to refurbish. And it needs to go into...
I think Chip Romero would love to have
it. Well, Chip Romero, I've mentioned it to him. But really, I would love to see it in the Copperfield place. Because
the two of them fight over that, those things.
Oh, yeah. And I, you know, I think that it would really be, see, if it went to either one of those museums, it would be great. But I think David would really love this. But I need to get it refurbished back to the original condition, because when I bought this thing, I was basically in my 20s.
Yeah.
And so when I was buying tricks, I wasn't thinking about the future of the collectability of this stuff.
Right.
I was thinking, I can barely afford even these things. I got to use them in my show.
So you weren't thinking of them as a collectible, but actually a functioning item.
I was.
You're going to get your money back for the shows you
It
did.
Was no different than buying something on you know, Magic Auction.
Sure.
It's just going to give it a new coat of paint. And so that's what I did. I painted part of it. We formica'd the boxes and everything. But yeah, I want to get that put back to its original look, because it's all the original.
And do you do that kind of work yourself, or do you give that to Bill Smith or somebody or other people to, I mean, you farm it out or you do it?
Well, this is something I probably could do, because this is such a special thing. Right. I'd probably give it to somebody like Ray Lum in Vegas or Bill Smith, someone that is
going to lovingly touch it up perfectly.
Yeah, who's going to really take the time and know what they're working with and not mess it up.
Johnny Gaughan may have been the one who built that originally or something.
Well, no, it was Owens.
Oh, it was Owens.
Yeah,
okay.
It was made by Owens.
A course, lot they're of the, no longer around.
No, and I was just at that sales that they had, the sale that they had last year. It was exciting and sad at the same time to be in the Owen workshop. That's what was so amazing. When they had all the sale of these things, for the first time, if you weren't a friend of Allen's in the past and you went to buy something at Owen's, you'd buy your thing in the display room in the front, and that'd be it. But now we get to go back into the workshop where we see all the tools and the saws and the
Aladdin's cave.
Oh, and everything was out. All the props were set up, and that's for sale. That's for sale. It was just, it was like going to Toys R Us. It was for the first time. It was amazing. So, yeah, so the original Doug Henning special, that first one, most of the equipment is built by Owens at that time. Later, he went to John.
Was that after, I assume, he had done the magic show on Broadway?
Yes, and a lot of those were Owen's props, too.
Okay.
You know, the thin sawing that we remember so vividly in the pictures. There was a Lion's Bride and a Mismade Girl.
I think Chip
all
has the thin sawing.
Yeah, I bet he does. Yeah, and he probably has the Mismade Girl as well. But
yes, he does. I know he has that.
Yeah, there were backdrops. I had purchased a backdrop that was used in the fire water levitation. Now,
you don't mean like one of those huge scrims?
It was gigantic.
Oh, I know what
you're talking
about.
Have been 40 feet wide by 25, 30 feet tall.
Right.
But the problem with this is it was the old school electric. So if you remember the backdrop that he has, that was all like black velvet, but it had giant stars. And they would actually raise some of the panels of this backdrop, and it looked like the stars were floating. It was gorgeous. Well, they were all twisting light bulbs in sockets, and on the back of this backdrop were wires, and it was old school. It wasn't fiber optics and made safe like it is today. I almost had the thing catch on fire at the San Gabriel Civic Theater in here in LA.
But did it actually work? I mean, were they
I got it working a few times, and I did it in shows. And then
wasn't worth the time and trouble.
It wasn't worth the time, and because the whole thing needed to be like rewired, and it was going to cost more than getting a new one, I donated it to a theatrical company where they were going to sell it off. Whatever.
Wow.
It was in a big hamper. But yeah, so exciting.
Yeah.
Seeing Doug Henning now, even though I'd met him a couple times, now he's in the room watching me. What a thrill.
Pretty
that
surreal
was.
Almost, huh?
Well, yeah, it was amazing. Yeah.
You know, you were talking about having a book that was dedicated to you. It reminds me, and I was at Ken Klosterman's house one time, and he had some canceled checks in a checkbook from Howard Thurston. And he said, Harry Anderson was here just last week, and we were going through it, and there was a check that was written to Harry Anderson. Somebody named Harry said, if you want it, take it out and keep it. And he did. And he said, Scott, if you see Scott in there or Scott Wells, he said, dude, I didn't find one, but I still kept one.
Did Harry cash that check?
Maybe he's going to now.
I think, yeah, he might.
So that was another book you were saying. So what would be another book that you would like to take on a desert island? It's important. You think like young readers or someone getting
into magic? Well, I have to still say, the book for me that has it all, if you want to become a magician overnight, when I say overnight, I don't mean overnight, even though
if you have an invisible deck and a business card, you're ready to go.
You're ready to go. The Mark Wilson Course in Magic.
Amen.
That's the one.
Yeah.
That has everything in it. And, you know, you can read that book from cover to cover a few times, and I bet you there's still a couple pages of things that you missed in there that you go back on. In fact, just today, I was having a conversation with a friend. We were talking about the tic-tac-toe trick, where you play with the audience, and then at the end
maybe
you turn it over.
Maybe at least that is a special trick, too, just on its own. That's a great trick.
That is a great trick. That's in the Mark Wilson Course in Magic.
No, I'm thinking of bingo. I'm sorry, bingo.
Oh, you're thinking of the bingo. Oh, the bingo cards.
Yeah, bingo cards. That's different.
Those are fun, too.
Yeah, that is fun.
Oh, those are great.
Have you done that?
I have, yes. Yeah, I know they were selling those cards for a while, and then it was just easy. You could they were all printed.
But I'm sorry, tic-tac-toe.
No, this was the tic-tac-toe where you put the O in the center, and then you say, okay, you know, you want the top left, right, middle, and you play tic-tac-toe, and of course you don't win, but at the end you turn the thing over, and it is a picture or a prediction, and now it's a marketed trick.
I always thought that was a Bev Bergeron idea. Of course,
it may be.
Yeah.
It may be. It
Bev
could be in there,
in
but
notes.
Hey, Bev was part of the Mark Wilson family, as we all know.
And he was one of those guys, kind of like Ricky Dunn, who I think invented everything.
Absolutely. yes. Yeah.
But those are great books.
Those would be the two sets. If you got the Tar Bill and the Mark Wilson Course, you can become Ed Alonzo in a week.
That's right. And then, of course, the tricks that are in Tar Bill need to be updated. Don't do them the way they are. I mean, they've got things with names of stars from back in the 20s or something. I mean, there are things in there that can be updated. I believe that Dan Harlan had recently done a good job in updating things. For an example, 20th century silks he does with 20th century socks, like socks
there
get lost
go.
In a dryer or
That's
something.
The way.
You know? Yep. So just think about that whenever you're reading Tar Bill about how that you can.
Yeah, isn't it
that.
Weird that magicians. We say silks, and the audience, they don't know what we're talking about.
Correct.
They're just thin handkerchiefs to them.
That's right. It's like sponge balls, too. I would never say sponge balls. First of all, you're putting the idea of saying sponge, which means it compresses.
That's right.
Why would you say that? It should
be
anything
unless you're insulting
else.
Someone.
That's right. I guess you can't hold anything else. It's going to be unless it compresses easily in your hand or something.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we should have other names associated with those kinds of trick names.
I agree, but the silks is always stuck, and it's so weird. And even as a kid, I would say, oh, yeah, I got to go to the magic shop and get silks. It just sounded
weird. Well, when you tell a magician that's one thing. But, I mean, you say scarves because people recognize you, your mother or your wife's scarves or whatever.
Well, yeah.
And that's what they should.
Yeah, my mom thought I was going to, like, a lingerie store. And I said, I'm going to go get some silks. She thought, okay, whatever you're into.
Who else was in the juniors with you at the time? I mean, I know who all was in the Long Beach Mystics. We've talked about that on past episodes and different people who have gone on to notoriety as well. But who were some other people, or were they a lot of the same people who were
well,
in the Long Beach Mystics?
It was a little bit of a different group. There were some duplications.
And you were in the second class, right?
I was the second class. The first class actually had their audition in what is downstairs, the pub here, where the original, I don't think it was called the Palace of Mystery, but
so
it was
the
original
stage. No, not the Hat and Hair Pub. But
right next
right
door
next to that, right, yeah.
was the main stage where Shamata would come, Channing Pollock performed there. Norm Nielsen. I mean, it literally, you and I looked at it the other night. It's like a 6-foot by 10-foot space of stage.
And no wings.
At no wings. So, yeah, that's where the original junior group auditioned. I came into the second troupe where they were just finishing the Palace of Mystery. So what was a two-level garage here became now one because that now became the whole floor with the Palace of Mystery, the Parlor Prestidigitation, and, of course, the Palace Bar and the phone booth and all that is all part of it in there. So, yeah, that had just – it was all fresh. I think the paint was still drying in places when I became a junior member to that area. But it was just, poof, what a time to be here. And I was either 13 or 14 at the time. Dinah Zimmerman probably remembers better than me. But I was either 13 or 14. And it was my second audition. I didn't get into the junior member on my very first audition.
Do you remember what you did the first time? And then
I came in and I did a dove act that I was doing, which was kind of just a good straight dove act for a 13-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was not what Lance Burton had done at 18 years old. But for 13, you know, it was fine. But it was just doves popping out. There was nothing to it.
Did you have body loads, or were you doing boxes?
I'm doing body loads. I think I had a dove and balloon tray from Abbott's. Mm-hmm. But the thing was, I didn't quite get it. I was just doing magic tricks. Mm-hmm. And the junior membership at that time, they were really looking for people that were a little different, that were creative, that were doing, taking a theme and building on that. And of course, I didn't understand any of that.
Not just bringing something from the magic shop and saying, look what I've just bought.
Well, more or less, that's what I had done, except that I was doing birthday parties and shows with this stuff, but not to the caliber that at that time Diana Zimmerman
expected from
the students. Yeah. So watching the people that did get in, that did make it on that audition that I came to, the one that I didn't make it on, I got an idea of what they were looking for. Mm-hmm. So the next time they had the auditions, which I think was a few months later, I started to prepare. And I put together a comedy dove act. So I took the regular dove act that I had and I changed it all. It wasn't as comical as like a great Tomasoni, but it had certain elements that were nice.
So you intended to have comedy from the very get-go, basically.
I mean, well, I tried. I wasn't funny, but I tried.
But that was your intent. I mean, you knew that was what your character was going to be.
I saw that the members that they were letting in to the audition that I went to were quirky or funny or different.
But were you looking up to people like Carl Ballantyne and others at the time?
Well, not yet, because I wasn't a member yet.
Okay,
gotcha. That door opened as soon as I became a member, and then I got to hang out with all of the masters, and that's when it really took off. But I auditioned with this dove act, and I had a couple gags. One of the gags was a torch to cane. So it was a very specific magician's gag.
Sure.
The torch is in one hand, but the cane appears in the other hand. So now I'm trying to blow the torch out. And then the stage manager comes on with a fire extinguisher and blasts me with it. And then now when the smoke clears, you see that now I have two canes. Yeah.
Okay.
So that was kind of what I did. Then one of the bits was that I had a rose to silk on my lapel.
Yeah.
Another magician's gag that would never have worked anywhere else. But I go and I pull the thing out, and maybe about 6 inches of the silk pop out of this gimmick. But it gets caught on purpose. Mm-hmm. Now I'm yanking and yanking. And finally, I rip the whole lapel off. And now I'm holding the lapel in my hand. I gather that up and I produce a bird out of
it. Funny.
So those were the bits. But those were the best two gags in the whole show. The rest was horrible.
Yeah.
So anyway, but it was enough to make it in. Because now they saw that here was something that was a little different. This was a guy that's a little bit creative. We're going to let him
in. How many people were in the class? 16, 20?
Yeah. It was less than 20 people. At that time, mostly all boys. I think we had one other gal in the troupe. But
once a month,
came right here to the castle, met in the Palace of Mystery, sat in the chairs in there. Every month, somebody would be prepared to do their act, and then everyone would sort of critique it or give ideas. And so this is how it went on. And we would plan for our yearly show called It's Amazing. It's Amazing. That might have been the Long Beach Mystic Show. Moments of Magic. That's what it's called. The junior members, Moments of Magic. And we used to do it at the Mayfair Theater, which was another small theater that Milt owned at the time.
Sure.
Which was
It's Magic Show.
Well, no, It's Magic shows went to the Variety Arts Theater. It was a big, giant stage.
Yeah.
The little one in Santa Monica, this Mayfair Music Hall, was an old music hall, and you would see people like, the Dr. Bombay from Bewitched, Bernard, look at that. Now I've forgotten. But people like that, vaudevillians.
Okay.
And they had great shows there. So we would have our annual junior show there, and we would be the stage crew. We would run the curtains. We would set the props for our fellow magicians. This was the training ground that was so important that I feel that the magician group doesn't have now.
Yeah.
And it's because we don't have that field trip of going to the Mayfair Theater or the Variety Arts Theater where we got to mess around and work in a real theater.
But they're still pretty exclusive as to who they let in, I assume, and it's
still
a small group.
Yeah, the other members that I can remember, the ones that were so impressive to me that have become very good friends over the years. The first one that impressed me the most was Mark Kalin. Mm-hmm. And he had a billiard act in that time. Mm-hmm. And he was already working in Vegas. He was working television shows. I mean, he was doing real gigs, and this was a real slick act. I mean, it was solid.
And Greg Wilson was also, was he about your age?
Yeah, Greg was the one that we were most envious of because he was on TV with Daddy Mark. And there he was doing the billiard balls and the thimbles, and he was a star, you know? And now Greg and I are friends, and we've worked on a ton of projects together, and he's a great video editor, and... if he wasn't in the magic business, he could work in television production and nobody would ever know that he did anything else in his life. So Mark Kalin was the first one that just blew me away. And I said, oh, one day when I grow up, I want to be Mark Kalin. Then the other one was Dirk Arthur. Mm-hmm. Now, Dirk Arthur had purchased an act from another magician. And it was an incredible act of colored birds popping out of cones of newspaper, and an emu appeared at the end out of a box. Wow. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And he was 16, 17 years old at the time. So, yeah, he bought the act from a magician named Ken Whitaker, who invented a lot of cool illusions over the years. But Ken Whitaker used to do this dove act with his assistant, Diana Zimmerman. Mm-hmm. And so when Ken Whitaker retired this bird act, somehow it kind of fell into the hands of Dirk, and he was able to purchase it for, I don't know what it was, but wow, Dirk was working TV and Vegas, and him and Mark Kalin and Greg Wilson, the three of them were superstars.
And Dirk also worked with Big Animal, Big Cats, as I recall.
Much later on, yes, he got, when he moved to Vegas and he took over the show at the Tropicana, he put Cats into the show, but it wasn't what he had when he was a teenager with this bird act. I mean, it was incredible. If anyone can find the Dirk Arthur bird act online and see it, it's...
What would you compare that to? Something like Joseph Gabriel?
No, it was a completely... It was almost like a zookeeper. Oh. So many birds were appearing.
Oh, so you had a theme, kind of a thing.
Yeah, it was just birds of every... You know, like I say, an emu appears at the end. He had chickens. He had ducks. He had geese. It was crazy. He had fantail pigeons, doves... regular pigeons. The act was so great that on one of the David Copperfield specials, David got a hold of him and he wanted to do this duck from the newspaper thing. It was a duck from Cone that Dirk Arthur was doing. And David does it on the special where it's a vignette where he's going to, he's trying to make it famous and he's in New York knocking on agents' doors and they keep,
Get away, kid.
Well, the one bit, he jams the suitcase into the door, and now the guy can't close it. Hey, I've got to, and then boom, and he closes the door and then chops the suitcase in half. Well, he picks up the newspaper and rolls it into the cone, and the duck comes out, Dirk Arthur style. And that shows you how good of an act this was when the king of magic at that time goes to Dirk Arthur and says, how much would it be for me to do this duck?
Who was what, about 19 at the time?
Yeah, had to be.
Wow.
So, yeah, a lot of great junior members. Much later became Kevin James, who in the beginning was like a rock star. He was in these space-age suits. He had very long hair and a mustache. And it was not what he was doing today. And then most of the act was built on incredible flipstick moves. And then he had a lot of other things in there as well. But, you know, it wasn't until... later, when he got Antonio and started doing the Chaplin doll and the floating rose, and you know, of course, sawing a man in half right in front of the audience and with a man that is in half. I mean, it's a miracle. So all of that stuff kind of came later. But Kevin was a genius.
He was always creative. Still is
always creative with the snowstorm. He had the
floating rose,
just unbelievable things, and still a genius. So to be in the company of these kind of guys is like being part of
the epicenter,
an award-winning team.
Exactly.
You know, and I was the worst one. I didn't have a clue, but I was watching these guys going, oh, man, they're so... It took me a long time to really go, okay, I think I'm getting the idea of it now. It took a long time to get there. But.
And then you decided this is what I want to do is some really extreme comedy kinds of things.
You know, I didn't really go into the deep comedy until my very last performance at the...
When you say deep comedy, you mean physical comedy?
Well, I think every verbal magician, even if they're an illusionist or whatever, they try and throw a couple jokes in, and all of a sudden they think they're a comedy magician.
Sure, not. No.
You know, and most comedy magicians that I see over the years, I mean, I have a few favorites, Jeff Hobson, and these people. But there are tons out there who claim they're comedy magicians who don't do good comedy or good magic, but they're doing comedy and magic. So that's how it is. And of course, magic lends to being kind of tricky or jokey. Oh, there's always jokes that come with the things. Or, oh, it's a sucker gag. Oh, turn it over. Oh, the other way. So comedy is there. But I think it really takes somebody who is more of a real comedian who can mix the two together and make for a funny show. I think that if you take a regular monologist, a stand-up comedian who's hilarious with timing, and teach him a couple good tricks, that's going to be one of the best comedy magicians you can find. So when you find guys like a Jeff Hobson and the funny ones like that that can just do improv,
Dave Williamson.
Yeah. I mean, I've worked with David. I worked a big private party years ago in Florida with David, and I was doing illusions on the stage, and David was the bumbling waiter in the audience. They thought that he was a real waiter, but no, he had this whole act. Uh-huh. It was just great. So when you see these kind of geniuses and you're working around them, then you go, those are, Michael Finney, and I can probably name two more.
Matt King. Yep.
Matt King. There it is. And there might be one more out there. But that's it.
Les Arnold's got a funny act, I think. And there's another guy, Les Arnold, who was a mentor to a lot of the Long Beach
Mystics. What an incredible thing that is. You know, I've known Les since I was a kid. Les used to even build props for me. And Les was basically doing magic as kind of a hobby on the side because he was a shop teacher,
right.
But an incredible woodworker. Mm-hmm. But, he would perform with his friends, Stan Allen and Caveney, and they would go and do shows. And, of course, he would bring the illusions. But he was just doing them. He was just performing the illusions. There was no comedy. There was no character. He was just doing good illusions. That was it. Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't until later that his daughter came to him, and they thought, couldn't I just be goofy and kind of dance around while you do your straight act? Well, just that simple idea alone has now led to Les Arnold and Dazzle.
A great career.
And it's one of the who cares about the magic tricks? It's just fun to watch
them. It's fun and funny.
It reminds me of when I was a kid and I would watch Goldfinger and Dove. Who cares about the tricks? I just love watching Jack and Dove dance around and move. Oh, it feels so good and natural. That's what theater is about. That's what entertainment is about.
Right.
And he also had the chops with some great Dove manipulation. And
okay,
so I can't say enough great about these guys.
I have to ask you for Sigmund and Freud.
Sigmund and Freud. My very last year of the juniors, when I was turning 21, I had basically decided that I was going to get out of the magic business.
Right. You were done with it.
I didn't know where I could go. I just wasn't good. And I think that if you're honest with yourself and you look at what you're doing and you look at the jobs that you're getting, that you realize, maybe it's not going to happen for me. And I just felt it wasn't going to happen. And so I just continued with, pursuing acting as my first love when I was a kid. So I just continued with that. So here we are coming to what would be my very last Moments of Magic show with the juniors, and I don't have an act. And Diana Zimmerman is saying to the juniors, all right, what do you have? Oh, I'm going to do my so-and-so act, the magic company. Okay, we'll do the subtrunk and the broom poles. And okay, Ed, what are you going to do? I don't have anything. What do you mean I don't have anything? All right, we'll get back to you. A couple more. Got to another kid. Danny Scott, what do you have? I don't have an act either. All right, come over and sit with Ed. You guys are going to put together an act. Well, that's how it was. So I sat with Danny on the side and I said, maybe we do a Siegfried and Roy spoof. I'll be Siegfried. You've got the dark hair. We put a mustache on you. You're Roy. I said, we'll call the act Sigmund and Freud. And he's like, okay. So then now the junior meeting is over.
Yeah.
And I say to Diana, okay, I think we have an idea. This is what we're going to do. I'm going to be Sigmund. He's going to be Freud. We're going to do Sigmund and Freud. We're going to work with a house cat. And she said, great. She said, now you're going to need blonde hair. And I said, yeah, I got to go and buy a wig. Don't buy a wig. I'm going to bring you one of my old wigs. So Diana, you know, a week or two later, she gets me one of her old wigs, and we take it to someone with a picture of Siegfried in the World's Greatest Magician's book. And I said, I need it styled just like this guy. And the guy styles the thing. So now I got that, and I've got the white tuxedo, and I'm bedazzling the thing with plastic rhinestones. We put together this crappy act. But the only thing that I had was, through my whole life, I've always done impressions of whatever it was, you know. Mm-hmm. But before everyone was doing Kermit the Frog and everything, I was watching Sesame Street and these shows, and I was, you know, hi-ho, Kermit the Frog here, today on the Muppet Show. I was doing all that as a kid, and Ernie and Bert and Cookie Monster. And so that's what I did, is impressions. So as a teenager, I was doing impressions of all kinds of things. And I did a Siegfried impression, so it made sense. And I thought, well, that's all I got. But I think that'll be good enough to get us in. We do a couple, doves to rabbit kind of things, but with cats in the end.
Right.
And we might have something. And then do a mind reading act where Roy sits in the chair and I cover him with a cloth, and we do that bit. So that was it. But I think what made it entertaining, because it was only for magician audiences,
of course,
was the fact that I was, all right, Roy, raise the cage. In the moment, you're going to see a 1,000-pound Bengal tiger kitty litter box. All right, Roy, concentrate. She's got a room key. Are you thinking of the room key she has? Ah, yes. And his name's going to be Sabu. So I would do that, and
that
it was
so
just
good.
Crazy.
Man, if you just close your eyes.
I know, right? And I was like, oh, this will be fun. So we did that at the Moments Magic Show. Next thing you know, now I'm booked on my first magic convention. I couldn't get a job at a magic convention with my lousy dove act or my telephone act that I did as a junior. But now this thing that I threw together in 10 minutes is now going to be booked at the SAM or the IBM National Convention in Hawaii. I'm pulling my hair out thinking, my goodness, I've made it. I'm going to be appearing, and I'm going to be on the show with Shimada.
You're right.
Oh, my. So it was a dream come true. So that's where it started. We did a couple of conventions, and then nobody wanted to see it anymore. The
gag was
over.
But then you met Siegfried.
Yeah.
And?
I met Siegfried, you know, many years prior to that. My mom and dad used to take a yearly trip to Las Vegas. We lived, you know, here in California, so it was just the four-hour drive, get our hotel. And then during the day, they would, you know, either go by the pool or, you know, start just playing the slot machines. And I think I was probably 12 or 13 at the time, and I would get on the buses, which cost a quarter.
Yeah.
And you could go up and down the strip. And I would go and hang out at Circus all day and, you know, play a few dollars worth of games and watch the circus acts. And sometimes there'd be magic acts in there, so I'd watch the magic acts. Well, once it came evening time, this is what I did. I'd get on the buses, and I did this every year. And it took a couple of years to sort of get this this scam working. So what I would do is I would go into the casino, right to the maitre d' at the showroom, and I would say, hello, I'm a young studying magician. I'd show the guy a card trick if he had a second or whatever, and I would say, you know, I'm a huge magic fan. Would it be possible that I could come in and just watch Paul Fiddler and Marie do their spot in the show?
Mm-hmm.
This would have been at the MGM or at the Bally's back in the 70s. And the guy would say, sure, you can come in and just watch that one part, and then you have to go out. So go ahead. So I'd be behind the curtain waiting and, you know, peeking in and seeing a couple of topless numbers,
mm-hmm.
which was a thrill
for a teenager,
for a 14-year-old kid. So anyway, now it comes time at the end of maitre d'. Okay, come on in. And I'd stand at the back, and I'd be watching Paul Fiddler make a crocodile appear in a cargo net, and it just blew my mind. And then I would go over and now try and catch the 9 o'clock show at another place. Well, one of the places was, of course, originally Stardust. The Stardust. And I'd go over to the Stardust and the maitre d', same deal. Oh, I want to see Siegfried and Roy. And they were just basically kind of an act in the show. They didn't do the whole show at that time. There were a lot of other production numbers, but they had a good chunk of it. So I would be in the curtain, back out of the curtain. Okay, come back in the curtain. And I would be able to see the different segments. Well, so this went on for years. And I saw several magic shows over the years. And one of the years that I come back, I'm a little bit older now. And the maitre d' says, after you watch the show tonight of Siegfried and Roy, I have a surprise for you. Okay, great.
Didn't say what it was.
Didn't say what it was. I thought maybe I could come back the next night and see the whole show.
Yeah.
I didn't know what it was.
See the showgirls.
I'm going to get a free program. Yeah. I didn't know what it was. So I see the segments of the show. I'm sitting in the very, very back, which was a booth that was empty where just some of the employees hung out until it was time for them to clean. The show's over. Everyone's leaving. And I'm sitting there. The lights are up full. Well, now here comes Siegfried, and just Siegfried, in a nice bathrobe with like some kind of a gold writing on it. I don't know if it says Siegfried or King. I don't know what it said. I'm trembling. And he comes up. Oh, nice to see you. You must be the young man he's been telling me about. Would you like to come back and see the props? Yeah, of course. Yes, of course. So I'm following him. Hey, what kind of magic do you do? He's asking me, well, I do this. Oh, great. Now we're walking into the dressing room. It was like a harem of magic tricks. And the ceiling was covered with fabric, like being inside of a tent. It was just... it was magical. And I'm walking now into the dressing room, and we pass Roy sitting in a chair watching a TV. He says, oh, that's Roy. Roy, say hello. Okay, I wave. And we go back. Siegfried's showing me a couple of the tricks and things, and he's got some props. And he goes, all right, my friend, I have to get ready for the next show. You know, it was a pleasure to meet you. Well, years later now, when I'm doing this Sigmund and Freud act, at the Magic Castle, with the junior member, Siegfried comes and he does a lecture.
Hmm.
And Peter Pitt was, you know, part of the group at that time. And Peter was very good friends with Siegfried. And Peter went up to Siegfried after, he goes, we have a junior member who does Sigmund and Freud. So he brings me over. And then I'm like, I don't know if you remember me, but I used to come and see the show. Of course, I remember. How are you? Good to see you. So now Peter Pitt says, all right, do a couple of the lines for him. Do it. So now I'm doing Siegfried impressions in front of Siegfried, which...
again, surreal.
Unbelievable. And so then Peter says to Siegfried, Siegfried, maybe you can, you know, give Ed a couple of the lines that you do from your shows. I was like, what? Now they're going to give me material? Now Siegfried's writing for me.
Wow.
This is crazy. So just a wonderful experience, and all because of timing of me being here as a young guy at the Magic Castle, learning from the masters, timing, the people we spent learning from.
And listening to them also.
Oh,
and,
yes. And Di Vernon smacking our hands. No, don't do the trick that way. It doesn't look natural. Just tons of stuff. Seeing Johnny Platt, and of course... you know, Jack and Dove were always here, so supportive.
Larry
Mark
Jennings.
Wilson, yep. Jennings. I mean, they were all to our disposal.
Charlie Miller.
They were all here. I was just born at the right time to be here with these great masters and be able to just watch what they were doing.
Well, I got a question also about the diversion you took also then into acting. And how did that come about? Did somebody see you from a studio saying, we may have a part for you, or were you casting...
I was just like every other out of work actor. You just go on tons of auditions.
Until they finally say yes.
Until they finally say yes. And then you go, okay, well, maybe this is more than luck once you get your second job. But when I was a kid, I started acting first. So my mother would put me in acting things and I would be in plays. And so that's what I loved.
Mm-hmm.
Later, when I was about 7 years old, so I started acting at five.
Wow.
Going to auditions. I remember going to auditions.
Was your mother a stage mother? Kind of.
She wasn't.
Okay.
If she would have been more demanding, I would have been a lot more successful. Mm-hmm. But she was just very knew that I loved this.
Yeah.
But not too pushy, and was always supportive, and would take me to my thing, you know, magic shows and whatever I was doing. So first, the acting bug got me, and I would do that in school plays in elementary school and then in junior high and high school. And I studied music and I played trumpet all the way from grade school, junior high, high school, and my first year of college. And then I dropped that. But I was in the jazz band, the marching band, the orchestra. And I was at one point in my life,
I
thought I was going to be a trumpeter. I mean,
I played the
good
cornet.
Enough.
I played the jazz band and all
cornet.
That myself. Yeah.
Well, that's how it started. Third grade. And they said, we're going to start some music classes here at the elementary school I went to. And so I went, oh, okay. Well, there was a little girl that I had a crush on. And she was going to go to the music class and select which instrument she was going to play. Well, I didn't really care about the instruments, but I wanted to hang out with her. Mm-hmm. So I went to the thing. And so then they said, okay, Billy, what instrument are you interested in? Oh, I want to play trombone. Okay. Tommy, what do you, drums. Okay. Well, we already have a lot of drums, but okay, maybe you could do that. And then she gets to this little girl, Colleen is her name. And she says, and Colleen, what do you want to play? And she says, I want to play the cornet. Okay.
That's for me.
Yeah. So now, you know, three down the row is me, Eddie. Oh, which instrument are you interested in? What do you think I said? Cornet.
Cornet.
Well, the teacher says to me right away, well, you know what? We've got a couple of cornet players. Why don't you play trumpet? Okay. I didn't even know what... I mean, I knew what a trumpet was, but I didn't know cornet, yeah. Trumpet, flugelhorn. I didn't
French
know.
Horn.
They were all the same to me at that. So I was like, the next thing you know...
I'm in the same section of the band with her, though.
Yeah. Well, that was the point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I became real good at playing trumpet because mm-hmm. I wanted to stay in there and impress her. And as it turned out, I went all the way through high school in my first year of college playing trumpet. And a band teacher kind of insulted me. You know, when you're a performer, you're so sensitive. And I'm just a jerk like that. I'm so sensitive. The guy said, I think I said to the professor, hey, I'm going to sign up for the band. You think I'll have a shot at first chair again? Now, first chair means that you're lead trumpet. And I had always been first chair. And the guy said, I don't think so. We got a lot of good players coming in this year. Okay. Well, I walked over to another booth and I said, I'm going to take all my elective classes now in theater. I'm dropping music. I was so upset. Hmm. So I took two more theater classes. I took
and you drop music like that to
drop music
theater.
Like a hotcake. Well, I'll tell you, it was probably one of the best things that I did in hindsight, because now I'm what I had done as a kid that I just gotten lucky with mm-hmm. as an actor. Now I'm actually able to study. I'm in plays. I'm doing musicals. I'm in Zorba the Greek. I'm in Fiddler on the Roof and The Music Man. All those important things. And so that really was a big turning point in my life to where it then put me into entertainment, because now I was just focusing on theater. So the next closest thing to being in theater was communication.
Right.
So I took classes at Bakersfield College, Bakersfield Community College, in communication. Mm-hmm. And one of the days that I went in to take my lab class, there was a note on the bulletin board that said, we're looking for a DJ midnight to 6 a.m. at KLYD radio in Bakersfield, where I lived. So, okay, I'm going to call that up. I went in for the job interview. Boom. Now I'm a DJ. Well, I did that for the next 3 years.
Did you start learning to be funny?
No.
On the spot? No.
I was just like...
You're spinning the records.
Oh, yeah. You know, it was just on the air. I was just learning mic technique. I was learning how to get those smiles in there. And coming up next is a little bit of mellow music, KLYD. And it was so funny because I always had this kind of high voice and I was trying to lower it. And the station manager would say, you're like, you know, don't talk so much. Just give the time and the weather and your voice isn't right. I was like, what are you talking about? Well, I was doing midnight to six. So the guy was asleep I was auditioning all night long for months and months and months. But actually, I became pretty good and I started to get really good at doing the overload of commercials. So I would go in and read commercials and cart them up on the carts.
Right.
And those would play all through the day. And next thing you know, now another radio station is offering me a job for a little bit over the minimum wage that I was making at the first one. And now I'm working there. But now I'm in top 40.
Wow.
Now I'm playing Michael Jackson and Madonna. And I did that for a long time. And I thought, you know what? This is what I'm going to do for a living. I'm pretty good at this. This mm-hmm. was good. And then, you know, you sit there behind the microphone and you just go, but nobody can see me now. All of my theater training, they can't see my face. So you kind of get good at talking to yourself.
Sure.
And you'll probably even notice in this interview, if we've been going 20 minutes or whatever, I've probably only looked at you 10 minutes of the time. But it's because of my training of not having anyone around.
Talking to the mic.
And talking to my headphones mm-hmm. is really what happens.
Yeah.
So that went on. And then I thought, well, you know, I'm not going to how successful can I be as a radio disc jockey? There was Rick Dees. This was way before there was Howard Stern. So there were nothing for me to look up to say, hey, this could be, you know. So I got out of that and I continued with the acting some more and then with the magic. And I had a week booked here at the Magic Castle. Peter Pitt was the entertainment director. And I called Peter up and I said, you know, I think I'm done with the magic. Getting out of the magic. I'm just going to go full bore with the acting. And Peter said, no. You're booked for the week. You'll do the week. Don't no arguments. That's it. And it was just one spot. So I only do 15 minutes. So I said to Peter, the only way that I can do this is when I go out now for auditions, I'm sort of doing a character. And I have some fake glasses that right. I put on. And I said, Peter, I'm scoring some commercials. I'm starting to get some parts. I go, it's kind of working for me. Well, congratulations, but you're still doing your week, he says. So I said, well, how about this? How about if I do my regular old act with the duck bucket and the take apart and my floating zombie and I had a sub trunk? But I'm going to do it in this new character with the glasses and I'm going to make my hair a little spiky. I don't care what you do. You do it. Well, I came out in the new look with the same old act that I was doing that just got mediocre reaction.
But now different look.
Yes. The audience went nuts. So I do my first opening segment with the ducks, with the duck transposition appears in the audience. And the first thing I say to the audience is, well, it's a good thing the geeky looking guy in the glasses isn't too bad after all. Boom. The crowd went nuts. And it was a shock. So I continued the act. Well, people start coming backstage afterwards, magician friends. Oh, my God, this is different. But basically, all I had done is just change the way I look, and I was just being a nerdy character. Well, Peter said, now you're on to something. He said, I'm going to call my friend at the Joan Rivers show. He's got to come in here this weekend and see you so that he can book you on the show. It's like, what? It's unbelievable. Saturday night, sure enough, the entertainment booker for the Joan Rivers show comes in, and Peter says, I'm going to MC that night. So he comes out, and he goes, ladies and gentlemen, the next act we have here was one of our young magicians here. He's got a very creative style. He would be perfect for the Joan Rivers show. That's how he introduces me. Yeah. Talk about name drop. Boy, to the really? Casting guy. Here's Ed Alonzo. Well, I came out, and it was huge reaction. Boom. I'm booked on the Joan
next
Rivers
day,
show.
He calls you?
Basically, he says, yeah. Well, no, that night. He says, yeah, I'm going to call you tomorrow. We'll give you a date. Well, yes, I did get booked on the Joan Rivers show, but
they got canceled.
Edgar passes away. That's Joan Rivers' husband.
Oh, husband. Yeah.
So she now is not going to do the show, but it's called now the Late Late Show. Mm-hmm. It was called the Late Late Show with Joan Rivers. Joan is out. She's a family disaster. So I think, well, that's it. Well, now they're looking for a new host for the show. And they go through several, and they find a young black comic named Arsenio Hall.
Yep, that's going to say.
Who is so funny and so personable. Yep. And Arsenio was an amateur magician. Lucky for me. So Arsenio's hosting the show, and they book me on the show anyway, which is now the Arsenio Hall show. I do the show. Unheard of. Arsenio calls me over to the couch, waves me over. I sit down for a minute.
You didn't know Arsenio.
No, never met him.
Yeah.
I do the show, and I think that was the show now where I had debuted the Twister illusion. That was the first time the Twister.
You invented that.
Franz Ferrari and I invented that. It was an idea that Franz had with changing the head box on top and putting a twisted body in what would normally be hidden by swords in a sword box that I already had. And I combined the two together. And put it to music to the Chubby Checker thing, which was made it perfect.
Again. Yeah.
And then to call the trick the Twister, which didn't have a name before that. Before that, it was just Joe Carson's
head twister.
Yeah. Head twister, but never just Twister. So I thought, okay, this has to be Twister. And then, you know, I did it on the show. And the next day, of course, all of the magicians are building them in their garage because they realize that it's something within their wheelhouse. They're like, oh, we know sword boxes.
Yeah.
Now it's got this Joe Carson head box on it with a couple little bells and whistles that Franz had added. Mm-hmm. And then now the Twister is born. And, you know, David Copperfield gets a hold of me within the next week and He's got to do it on his special. But so there I am on the Arsenio Hall show, and things are rolling. And I'm seeing now the difference of just being the regular magician I was, changing to, all right, I'm going to put these glasses on and do kind of a nerdy character. And now I'm watching it for the first time on network television. I'm sitting there disappointed because it's not believable to me. Who's going to believe this? It's just a nerdy guy. So luckily, the Arsenio Hall show, they liked what I did, and I went back and I did 12 more episodes. I went on to do the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, an HBO special called Live from Planet Earth, tons of stuff, which gave me the advantage of watching all of these things and studying myself. And that's where I said, I have to make this really believable so that when the audience comes in, not only do I have cool and funny magic, but they think that this is this guy who's doing it. That's him.
Right.
There's no other difference.
Right.
And if I can do that,
the same on stage is off.
Yes. That's the greatest magic trick of all, because that's when you become endearing and lovable to the audience.
Right.
When they can believe you, when they don't think it's just a character and they're just like, oh, that's a wig. Well,
like from Saved by the Bell, I assume people come up to you all the time and think you're that character, that same person.
You know, I am blessed with the fact of that. I, you know, even when I was a teenager, I always thought that I was like a young Lon Chaney because I love to do makeup things on my face.
Yeah, yeah. Man of a
I can
faces.
Change very few things on my face and hair and really become a different person. Mm-hmm. So this is the beauty of what has happened by doing this hair and glasses character is when I just have my hair laying down like it is now and I'm not wearing the fake glasses because I don't wear glasses.
Yeah.
I can go anywhere in the world. I can, for the most part, I'm a regular guy. More and more now, magicians recognize me in this with my normal look because they've seen me in interviews and things. But there were years that I could go to international and national magic conventions to the dealer's room.
Invisible.
The worst part about it was that the dealers wouldn't help me. They wouldn't, you know, they didn't, they just thought I was some guy back there. So they would help the magicians that they knew. Well, let me show you this, Bob. Hey, Dave, come here. And so I'd be, but it was nice to be the fly on the wall and watch all these things.
Right.
And even today, basically 90%, whether I go out in public, even if they're Saved by the Bell fans or fans who saw me on other shows like Full House or Modern Family or whatever, I'm unrecognizable. And I realize having friends that are actors and are famous people, they're never left alone. They're always bothered. They can never,
like, you know, you're talking about your friend Neil Harris.
Yeah, he's a perfect example of Neil and I were at Disneyland many years ago waiting in a line to go into a ride. And you know how the lines sort of zigzag to where
serpentine.
Yeah, you're one way you're facing like the other line. Well, we were standing there kind of talking in line and all of a sudden, a lady with a camera, like, just leans right in front of Neil's face, snaps the picture, and then leans back into her line like it never happened. Mm-hmm. And we would just sort of look at each other and go, no, that was interesting. So those are the kind of strange things, or just getting ready to eat a bite of your mac and cheese and someone saying, excuse me, my daughter loves you. Could we get an autograph or a photo? So that's difficult. And I understand that the extra, you know, problems that go along with being a person like that and being bothered all the time. Not that I'm famous enough to where if I went around with my glasses and hair all the time, I would get that kind of attention.
Yeah.
But I would get more than I get like this, and it's a blessing. I love it.
When you were traveling with Britney Spears, that had to be a little bit different because she's the celebrity and everybody wants her, and it's like, get out of my way.
Well, it was almost the opposite because I was so close to Britney in the show and as a friend to her that people knew that I was close to her, and so they would want to get to me to get to her.
Okay.
And so that was different. There was even a couple of months of the tour, towards the end of the tour, where I would walk her out in the arena to get under the stage. So what I mean by that is most of the places we played were 30 and 60,000 seat arenas, like a football stadium or indoor basketball arena. And the stage would be in the middle of the court or the field. And we would be, our dressing rooms would be the locker rooms.
Okay.
And so we would have to come as a cast, all of the dancers, the acrobats, because the show was a circus show. And Britney would all have to walk out and then get under the stage in front of the audience. And in the very beginning, what is an old rock and roll trick is that they would sneak the performer into these stages and venues in a hidden way. Mm-hmm. And in the very beginning of the tour, we had a giant road case that was made for Britney.
Wow.
So on the outside, wow, it just looked like a big anvil case.
Sure.
But the inside was plush with a TV screen.
Holy cow.
And fuzzy carpet and bottles of water and a mirror and a fan and all of this.
It wasn't like inside a subtrunk.
Yes, it was like living in a subtrunk that had electricity. So that's how Britney would go to the stage for months. Is she'd get wheeled out and the cast would come out walking. And then
Britney
one day
has left the building.
Yeah, literally. Yeah. One day Britney says, "I don't want to go in the box anymore." Hmm. And they're like, "Well, what are we going to do? We can't." Everyone's flustered. So I say, you know, to Jamie Spears, "I have an idea." I said, "All of the dancers are walking out and they've got these kind of hoods on."
Yeah.
Where they have a hood on over their head. They look kind of like monks, but all in black. And they would come out and was very solemn. And it was interesting. Mm-hmm. I said, "You're going to put Britney in one of those hoods like that."
Yeah.
I said, "I'm going to wear the robe as well, but I'm not putting down my hood because I got the big hair and the glasses."
Yeah.
And the people are going to see that. And they're not going to see who's on my right.
Hmm.
And I said, "Britney, come here." And she took my arm in arm. And I said, "Are you ready?" And she put the hood up and she could still see.
Yeah.
And I threw my hood back. And for the next several months, I walked her straight out in front of the audience with the people just cheering, thinking, the show's about to start. I'd walk her right under the thing, give her a little hug. Showtime.
Wow.
So, you know, that was the way to do it.
She must have loved you for that idea.
She did. And, you know, that was a time when, as we know now, as we've seen the news and the way that it all has come out, there was so much control that her father and the estate had that she couldn't be her own person. And maybe in the very beginning, she needed that help. She needed that guidance. And then as things went on and whatever, no, it just was too much. But yeah, no, it was the complete opposite. People wanted to get to her, and it was just
a
great
fun tour. That was a carnival or something.
It was called Circus.
Circus, yeah.
And what happened was they wanted to put a magic act in the circus show, so they contacted me to write the number, to come up with the number. And at that time, I was in New York promoting the Masters of Illusion on the Good Morning America show for Gay Blackstone. And so I did my Good Morning America thing, and I got back to my hotel in Manhattan, and I got my email from the production company saying, "This is the song we want to use for the magic act."
Mm-hmm.
So I downloaded the song, and it was called Ooh Ooh Baby, and I was playing it on my computer in the hotel room. And when I block out stuff, I get up and I dance it out or I pretend like I'm doing the trick. So I'm listening to the music, and I'm already deciding what the tricks can be. I can visualize the whole thing in my head, but I can't visualize the magician, who is a dancer, a very attractive dancer, a male dancer that they want to use to play the part of the magician who they'd introduce me. So I've got him in my head, and I'm trying to think of the moves, and it's just not working for me. I can't. With this song and with that, it doesn't make sense. So then I had made a decision in my head. I said, "Here's what I should do. I think I'm the guy who should be the magician for this thing. So I want to choreograph and create this number with me doing it. And then I'll go to LA next week when I get back, and I'll go in and I'll show it to Britney, and I'll show it to her manager, and then they can decide if they like the number." But already secretly hoping that if they see me do it, they might think, "There it is. That's it." Well, I had no idea. So I rehearse with a girl who's a dancer, a friend of mine, and she's a blonde, very Britney-esque, about the same size and everything. And I put this routine together, which started off with me making a silk decane. I show a crystal box empty. I cover the box, woof, pull the cloth off right away. The dancer's there. The other, a cane turns into some flowers. I go to offer them to her. She snubs me, and she's taunting and teasing me, but I'm chasing her. So I wrote it as a chase, just like a magician who maybe has an attractive assistant working with him.
But he's spurned.
Yeah. He definitely wants to try and get to know her a little better, but it's not going to happen. He's going to have to impress her with the magic. So that's the routine I wrote. So it went from that and then to the zigzag illusion, because I thought that's a good visual illusion that can be done in the round. And I have some little tweaks and things that'll make it interesting. Mm-hmm. That was the other thing. You had to remember everything was going to be in the rounds. It was going to be seen 360 from up above on a giant
just
screen.
Just like a circus.
Just like a circus. So we did that. And I said, okay, the last number has to be like a striptease kind of number where she's really taunting and teasing this magician. Now she gets into a cabinet. The curtains go up on it. And she's handing out her clothes one at a time. But in a funny way to where when the main part of her costume comes, when she throws it out, the magician goes to grab it, and of course it lands on his face. Why? I can't see. It's got to be stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I went in and basically showed them this routine to Brittany and her manager and the people that are producing the show, and they saw the thing. That was it. They were quiet. There were a little applause afterwards from the five of them. And I went back with the dancer, and we're kind of pushing the props out of the studio.
You weren't sure whether they liked it or not.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
But my friend who was there, who was going to build a major part of the props for the show, not magic props specifically, but he builds staging, whatever, David Mendoza of Magic Craft.
Magic
Or Show Effects is the name of his company now, Show Effects. So David is sitting with them, and they asked David, do you think Ed would be interested in going on the tour? Well, David already knew what I'd done. He says, yeah, well, I can check with him. Yeah, I don't know. So 5 minutes later, David walks over with this grin on his face. He goes, oh, guess what?
Guess what for you?
I said, well, they like it? They know to like it. They want you to go on. I was like, oh, this is amazing. So with good planning and good hopefulness and good intentions and a good positive energy, and only putting a magic act together that would impress Miss Spears and her company was what I had on my mind. Mm-hmm. And if I was able to be part of the package, that would make it even better. And that's what happened. And it turned out to be a wonderful experience traveling not only in the United States, in all of the major arenas, but then in Germany and in France and in England.
Wonderful.
It was unbelievable. And to spend that much time with her was just...
We could have another podcast talking about all of the stories, I'm sure, that you had behind the scenes and everything.
Yes.
I'm sure. Amazing.
Yes. This is the time where we take a break and we tell your listeners, check back, because this is the everlasting story. In fact, you won't even need any other guests. I'll just come on every week for the next 2 years and we'll go over the same nonsense. But this has been so fun.
Thank you, Ed. This has been just absolutely marvelous.
Yeah.
For people who listen to the podcast often, they say, I hear Scott talk way too much. I just was fascinated.
Listening. I didn't give you a chance, did I?
I didn't know, and thank you. Thank you. You're a great guest.
Well, it's like I said, now if I can just get the talent of making eye contact again, you know, and it's so weird because I do the same thing because I do a lot of radio shows and podcasts. One of them that I did a few years ago was the Secret of the Vanishing Statue. Now, this is a famous one, and it's on NPR Radio. And if your listeners love what we're doing here, tune into this. And I think it's called The History of Magic or something. But it's a guy who was an amateur magician who is now a famous NPR Radio. I mean, it's huge. There's millions of people that listen to his show every week.
Yeah.
And one of them is his attempt to expose the secret of David Copperfield vanishing the Statue of Liberty.
I heard this.
And the guy reaches out and he finds me.
Yeah.
And I agree to do it because David and I have stayed friends. Even from years ago when I worked with him, we've stayed friends. So when somebody comes to me like this...
And the reason they came to you is because you were actually
on
the ground. You were, as you said, living...
Yeah,
you
lived in the museum base of the statue in a
there
sleeping
Ellis
bag.
Island.
Yes, that was part of being part of the Copperfield team back then is coming up through the ranks.
Amazing.
So, yeah, because I was there and part of the, this
what
amazing show, I knew that being a magician and still being friends with David, that there wasn't one question this guy could ask me to throw me mm-hmm. to expose the secret of mm-hmm. the statue. Mm-hmm. But I'm certainly going to reel him in with my words and my invisible rope. And I did, and I suckered him in. And it ends up being a really nice interview. And in the end, you really never learn how the Statue of Liberty has vanished. But you get to see the camaraderie of what the real magician's code means. Mm-hmm. If you listen to the words that I say, and sure enough, you know, a few weeks later, David called me and he said, "Wow, thank you so much. You're incredible.
Yeah.
You are still part of our team." And it's not just that I'm part of David's team, I'm part of the magic team.
Right.
And this is
beautiful.
You know, this is what we've spent our whole life doing, right?
Well said. And as we close, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. And so I always like to ask my guests what it is that your philosophy of life. I mean, what is your magic word? Not like abracadabra.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and you've said so many things, and it kind of, this is a good
point. My philosophy is that when I'm performing, I just want to bring smiles. I want to bring laughter.
Yeah.
I want to make people forget about their daily problems. Because you know what? If you're doing it correctly, and if your heart is into it, it's a double-sided coin. Not only are you helping the lives of the people that you're performing for them to forget about their problems, but it also makes you forget about your own problems. Mm. And you're in a fantasy world where it's just happy land. You're making people laugh. They're laughing back at you. They're supporting you. You're supporting them. It's just a love situation. You know, my goal has only been maybe not to always fool the audience, but to always entertain them. Mm-hmm. If the people walk away from seeing my show and they remember me more than a trick, then I've done my job.
Wow. Well said. Ed, this has been delightful. Thank you so much. It's great being here in the library at the Magic Castle and spending some time. You might hear some people behind us in the W.C. Fields bar laughing through the doors.
That's right. It's because we're doing comedy in here. We're funny.
That's right. You're a funny guy. Thank you for your friendship. I'm so glad we got to spend so much time together this week then, too.
This 15 minutes went by like 45 minutes. Unbelievable.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Bill Larson
and Milt.
And Milt. Without the Bill and Milt, we couldn't be here.
That's right.
I mean, this is the thing. And of course, it'll all be done by the time this podcast is heard, but I'm currently running for the board of directors, and it's because my heart is with the Magic Castle. Mm-hmm. My heart is for the magicians, and I think I have a lot of good ideas and things that will only make it better for the performers here. And so when I say thank you to Bill and Milton, I say it every time I'm here, when I walk into the building, it's just, mm-hmm. oh, you can feel their energy. And Milt's even here tonight.
When we were here the other night, we were sitting in the Al Bar. We sat there for an hour talking with him, and it just is.
That's right. And I didn't understand a word he said.
I recorded I had my microphone on, and I don't think that will air.
This is the amazing thing about our Milt Larson. He's about to turn 90 years old, and he's still creating new ideas.
Yeah.
He's still writing scripts for new projects. He's still doing his radio show every week.
Yeah. And working on that place down in Santa Barbara.
Yeah. I mean, so that's why I say Bill and Milt, the two brothers who have changed so many lives in magic. So, yes.
The house of Milt built.
That's it. Here we are.
That's right. Thank you again, Ed. This is fantastic.
Scott Wells, thank you so much. I appreciate being here with you. This has been more than fun. It's been great.
Right.
And I never do this. That's why the magicians don't hear me on all the other things. I try to be very selective. I only want to try and do the things where I know that there are going to be a lot of magicians tuning in to hear it, mm-hmm. so that what we've done here in the last hour isn't wasted.
Yeah, that's great. And it won't be, for sure. It'll live on forever in the archives. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Ed Alonzo. This is Scotty out. Well, I don't know about you, but I think that was just a fantastic conversation. I'm so glad to have captured this lightning in a bottle. It was wonderful listening to what Ed had to share with us here this week, and I hope that you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. If you'd like to make sure you don't miss another episode like this, be sure you have subscribed to our pod letter. If you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there you can subscribe to the pod letter, and each week you'll get an email that will tell you who is on from week to week and who's coming up next week, and also some suggestions questions from the archives on who you may have missed, as well as any other little tidbits if we have contests or things like that that have been released. So it's important that you do go out there. And also, if you have the opportunity to help us a little bit with some financial aid, we certainly would appreciate that. In fact, I want to welcome our newest friend of the Magic Word, Lance Burton. While I was recently at the Magic Collectors Expo, Lance gave me a little donation, and so that makes him a friend of the Magic Word. Thank you very much, Lance, for your financial aid, and we thank each and every one of the rest of the friends of the Magic Word. And if you'd like to join him and others, again, go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and there you will find some information on how that you can donate or give a monthly pledge then as well. There are a lot of things coming up in upcoming episodes. I will mention right now, next week's episode will not occur on our normal Thursday that we release. We're going to wait until later because we've got the Effector's Finger Flicking Frolic, or the 4F convention. I always like to give convention reports, and this one's going to be a little bit unusual since it's going to be actually a digital or a Zoom convention, and I will have that not only as an audio, but I'll have that then as a video as well. That convention will be taking place on Saturday, April the 30th, so that will be released sometime, if not that night, then perhaps early on Sunday, sometime on May 1st. But be sure to tune in for that. And again, more information will be in the pod letter. One of the things that Ed talked about early on and again at the end was the fact he was running for the board of directors. And just as a follow-up, he did win. So now he is officially a director on the board of directors for the Academy of Magical Arts. So congratulations, Ed. Well done. And I know you're going to do a great job in helping to move the Academy further. Speaking of which, many of you have recently heard where Randy Pitchford had recently purchased the Magic Castle. I just spoke with him last week as well. And he was confirming that this is going to be a very positive thing for the Magic Castle and for the Academy. He has purchased not only the property, but also the name of the Magic Castle. And so it is assured to be a viable entity well into the future without having to worry about negotiating with the Glover family as they have done from time to time. Randy now owns it, and so it is in good hands. Randy Pitchford, who some of you may know the name, Pitchford, of course, comes from Richard Pitchford, who was Cardini, who is a relative of Randy Pitchford's. I mentioned earlier there is an advantage to subscribing to the pod letter because you are given early information about contests we have running from time to time. We recently had a contest for 6 copies of the book Seventh Heaven by Lewis Jones that was republished by Charlie Randall of H&R Magic Books. And the contest ended last week, but because we had the convention reports, I really didn't have a chance to congratulate the winners. So if you'll give me a moment of time, I would like to congratulate those. There are many people, dozens and dozens of people who had entered the contest, and unfortunately only 6 names could be drawn. So those winners are Kent Dickison, Chris Wilcox, Michael Grant, Edward Taylor, David Meadows, and Dan Sclair. Congratulations, guys, and if you didn't hear your name drawn, sorry, maybe you'll have better luck in the next contest. I'm not knowing for now when the next contest is going to be, nor what it is that might be offered, but listen for the next contest that will be announced here on the Magic Word and also posted in the pod letter as well as our blog at themagicwordpodcast.com. One last little thing before we get out of here. Ed had referred to a podcast he was in sometime back around 2016 or 17 called This American Life with Ira Glass. And if you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there will be a link where you can go back and listen to that podcast where it talks about the vanish of the Statue of Liberty. Not only that, it's about a 1-hour podcast that talks about magic in general, but the last part of that talks about the David Copperfield vanish of the Statue of Liberty. And if you want to just hear Ed's portion, I think it starts at about time stamp 53 approximately, so you can go back and listen to that. And again, that link is on themagicwordpodcast.com. And so until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to bring smiles and laughter to your audience, because if your heart is in it, you help people forget about their troubles and you forget about yours. This is Scotty out.